There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We are spending the next hour talking all things gynecological as Dr. Rosa Lee Sant from the Primavera Clinic in Healthcare City joins us. Dr. Rosa Lee Sant, thank you so much for joining us in studio. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for the invite.
And welcome to our lovely new studio.
Oh my goodness, I'm impressed.
Aren't they gorgeous?
They're
still
lovely.
Buzzing. I absolutely love it. It smells gorgeous. We've got daylight. I am delighted. So you're a very busy doctor, of course. You're dealing with fertility cases. You've got women coming to you for their kind of general gynae checkups.
Yes.
And you're also delivering babies.
I am indeed, yes. I'm an all-rounder. I'll do a little bit of everything. I'm a general gynaecologist, really. Special interest in certain things, but general gynaecologist.
What's the special interest in?
Special interest is in minimally invasive surgery, particularly hysteroscopic surgery, from the gynaecological side of things. And high-risk obstetrics, of course.
And what prompted you to get into the gynae world?
Oh, oh my goodness, that's a difficult question. Two things, I think. I think I was completely fascinated with the how two cells divide, come together, divide and produce a human being. I think that the physiology of pregnancy is absolutely mind-blowing.
It is.
Yeah.
It truly is. When you think about literally just bones being created inside you, skin, features, colours.
Right.
It's absolutely unbelievable. When you think about it from an abstract point of view, it's weird.
It is very weird. And you see now what's happened is we have access to ultrasound and we do a lot of ultrasound throughout the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And while before you sort of there was something inside and now there's a human being outside and he's crying. Now actually we realize that they're actually a human being inside as well. So they're developing and they develop traits and habits and characteristics that you can pick up even on ultrasound, even at 20 weeks.
It's so funny. I had a scan done the day before I gave birth to my second. So I had literally 24 hours apart what she looked like inside and then what she looked like out. And then my other daughter always had this, as you said about the traits, she'd always put her hands behind her head,
that's
like as if
right.
she was relaxing. And that's how she would sleep.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Everything from hiccups to positions.
That's right. So that was the thing that attracted me to obstetrics. And of course, the gynecological side of things, I like surgery. I love surgery. So that was a nice mix for me.
Well, we're very lucky to have you here. Now, in the news recently, we're hearing more about why we should be talking about what they call below-the-belt cancers.
Mm.
And every year, 21,000 women in the UK develop gynecological cancer. But it seems many of us are too shy to speak up, with a fifth of women feeling unable to speak to their doctor about their symptoms. There still seems to be some stigma attached. So what we want to do now is just give a little bit of a recap and a bit of education around the symptoms we should be looking for and what these cancers actually are. So when it comes to womb, so uterus or endometrium cancer, what are the kind of consistent or common symptoms that we should be looking for there, doctor?
Well, endometrial cancer is an easy one, actually. It's because it usually presents relatively early with irregular bleeding. The problem, of course, is that there are many other things that cause irregular bleeding. And that's when sometimes we become a little bit complacent and not investigate people fully because, oh, you know, this must be your hormones going to the change, this and that. So at least it shows us that we should be looking. And from that point of view, we pick it up relatively early. So whether it is irregular bleeding, leading to an ultrasound, leading to some blood investigations and maybe even an MRI or a curettage, then you have a histopathological diagnosis of the cancer. So that's the easy one.
So if you're postmenopausal and you start bleeding again or getting periods again, that would be something to look out for.
For sure. You're allowed to make a mistake for 1 year after your menopause. After that, you have to go to the doctor if you bleed.
And is womb cancer hereditary?
That's a difficult one to answer. The answer is probably no, but there are some traits where we have familial cancers. It's not very common. They're usually estrogen related. So the endometrial cancer, remember, is linked to colon cancer and breast cancer, as is ovarian cancer. Okay, so yes, there are a small percentage that are run in families, but it's not really hereditary.
Okay, cervical cancer we're hearing more and more about.
Yes.
We've discussed it in depth in the past off the back of UK celebrity Jade Goody, who prompted about 500,000 women in the UK to get checked, and it sadly has tailed off now. That so-called Jade Goody effect seems to be less effective, and it can affect older and younger women alike.
The problem with cervical cancer is, or the shame is, that it actually affects usually a very young woman. Mm-hmm. So Goody, I think, was 27 or 28 when she passed away. And, you know, that's a horrendous age to be, you know, to either have cancer or to give up fertility to as a part of your cure for the cancer, or to have, you know, such aggressive surgery and chemotherapy. And unfortunately, it does also does not give you really symptoms very early. And it's usually picked up through pap smears or HPV testing. And that is a shame, really, because we have the means of picking up the cancer before it becomes cancer. But obviously, people have to come for their tests. And because of organizational constraints, financial constraints, access constraints, and that sort of thing, sometimes people do not come for their checkups, for their pap smears.
That's the thing. You know, in the UK and many other parts of the world, you get a letter through the door. It says, you know, please make an appointment for the next 3 months. And here the onus is very much on the person, the patient, to make that appointment. So if you are squeamish, you don't want to have a smear, there's not necessarily anybody calling you up and chasing you about it. So it's something we all need to take responsibility for. You know, you mentioned the HPV virus there, and that's something that young girls and in some parts of the world, young men are being vaccinated against
as well. Yes.
So we can take some steps in our kind of preteens and teens too.
Yes, the vaccine is most effective in young children, pre-pubertal and pubertal children. But it actually remains very effective up to the age of 26 when the FDA approval has been issued. But also beyond that, a lot of doctors tell their patients, oh, sorry, you're too old. Or even they do an internet search and they find that out. But in all fairness, it's not true. Mm-hmm. Because extension studies have shown that it's 100% effective almost at 26. But it's 70% effective at 55.
Wow.
So you still can get
still
a lot of protection.
Okay, good to know for anyone who has not had that vaccine. Now, you mentioned ovarian cancer being linked to the BRCA gene, which is that inherited gene that increases your risk of breast cancer. In terms of symptoms, I've heard things like feeling bloated or feeling full.
Ovarian cancer is a gynecological's nightmare, okay, mm-hmm. because it presents always very, very late, okay? If you have swelling and bloatedness from that is as a result of ovarian cancer, it means you're probably stage 3, stage 4.
Okay.
So it is something that we fear a lot. And the only way of catching it early is through repeated ultrasounds and blood tests, which are not really very specific. So they worry a lot of people for nothing. But recently there's been a scientific article published that showed in the patients who were at risk because of the BRCA gene, then actually they did an ultrasound 3 times a year for them, together with a blood test for tumor markers 3 times a year, and they started catching the cancers at stage 1.
Wow.
So it is actually, this is the first time that we've actually got a screening program that is sort of effective. True, it's only for a very specific group of people, because you can't screen people for 3 times a year for the potential of ovarian cancer. But at least we can do something for those specific people.
Who are definitely in that more high-risk category. Now, staying with the ovaries, and I'm glad you're in today because there was something on the BBC Health News just yesterday talking about scientists taking early steps towards developing an artificial ovary.
Yes.
This is obviously with the aim of improving fertility preservation treatments, and it's generally women who are at risk of becoming infertile, such as those who've received chemotherapy. What's your take on this? Could you see this happening in the future? Haven't had human testing yet, and maybe 3 or 4 years in the future, you know, we might see it in practice.
Maybe a bit longer. yes, for sure. I mean, I believe in science, so of course I will really hope that this will work. We've always had a bit of an issue with we've preserved ovaries, we've preserved ovarian tissue for a long period of time, but when. And when the treatment that the patient needs for cancer is radiotherapy, so it's localized, then what they used to do is they used to transplant the ovary, take the ovary, transplant it somewhere else where it's not going to be hit by radiotherapy, and the ovary remains alive in the woman.
Wow, that's so clever.
Very clever.
What they're talking about now is removing parts of the ovary and altering them and then transplanting later when the woman wants to conceive.
Because you see, when you have chemotherapy, that doesn't work because wherever it is, the ovary is going to be affected. Mm-hmm. So what they're talking about is they're talking about taking the ovary and freezing it. And when they were doing that, because ovary is such a dense tissue, I mean, we have problems freezing eggs sometimes until, you know, the recent advances, but ovary is even more difficult to freeze. So the outcome was not very good. So what they were thinking of doing now is they were thinking of actually what we need from that ovary are only the eggs. So if they could extract the follicles, keep the follicles alive, exactly how they're going to do it at the moment is a little bit controversial.
We'll leave it to the Danish scientists.
Probably animal transplant. Mm-hmm. Okay. Keep them alive and then transplant them back when, or rather, then use them for IVF when the woman wants to get pregnant.
So great news for potentially for women who have been through that chemotherapy or are facing it in the future. So fingers firmly crossed. Your questions next. Dr. Rosalie Sant joins us from Primavera Clinic in Healthcare City. It's your chance to have your health concerns addressed by an expert. She's an expert gynecologist and can talk about anything from contraception to pregnancy, any hormone issues you're facing, checkups. So please do get in touch. Ready for the first question, Dr. Rosalie Sant?
Yes, sure.
No name on this one, saying, hi, I'm a 29-year-old female. I've been told by my doctor that I, quote, need to have a cervical smear test, even though I'm not sexually active and never have been. She says I need to have it done because the test shows precancerous cells in the cervix. It's booked in for next month. I've never been sexually active or had anything like this done before, and I'm really worried it will hurt. Will the nurse understand it's my first smear? I'm so nervous and feel like a complete chicken for being silly over something like this. Thank you.
No, she's not being a chicken at all. I mean, this is of course a natural concern. If she has never been sexually active and if she has not used tampons, then I actually would recommend that she does not do a pap smear. Pap smears check for precancer of the cervix. There are two types of cancers. There's the squamous cell carcinoma, which is the most common one. And then very, very rarely we have an adenocarcinoma, which is not very common at all. Now, we can check for squamous cell carcinomas through an HPV typing. You can do an HPV swab without localizing the cervix by touching externally and a little bit gently internally, but with a cotton bud, not with an instrument or a brush. So it's not painful at all, actually. It's just a bit of a discomfort if it's done gently. And that way, if you're HPV negative, then the chances of you having a cervical pre-cancer is extremely low. So I would suggest that she probably would have a chat with her GP and suggest that she may have an HPV typing instead.
Good. Pre-warned is forearmed. And I think that's absolutely right in terms of doing a bit of research and going to your doctor with that bit of knowledge. Really hope that helps. A message here from Naisha saying, can you please advise on the difference between the two coils? I've had three children, the youngest is one, and I don't want any more, but also don't want to go back on the pill. Any advice? Good question there, because I actually didn't realize there were two types of coils.
Yes, there are two types of coils. There's a hormone-containing coil. It contains progesterone in very, very low doses, and the name of that, the brand that's found in this country is called Mirena. There are other brands in different countries with lower doses. And then there's the copper coil, the traditional copper coil. And the traditional copper coil will allow a period every month. So people like that. Some people like that because they want to have a period every month.
You don't worry that you're pregnant. Yeah, sounds about right.
Some people don't want to have a period every month if possible. So a copper coil is very, very effective as a contraceptive. There, it has two potential things that we warn patients about, and that is that it may make your period a bit heavier. And also, if it fails, you can have an ectopic pregnancy. But it's very rare that it fails. And as long as you're warned about it, then you know what to do. Unfortunately, it had a bit of a bad reputation in the past because the quality of the coils wasn't so good and maybe they weren't placed properly. So the risk of ectopic pregnancies was sort of known because people, you know, you'd know of somebody who've had it. Mm-hmm. It's actually not that high. And it's a very, very effective means of contraception that is completely hormone-free.
Ah, so that's interesting. If you have got hormonal imbalances that you've been concerned about,
that's right.
So that's a kind of a localized, rather than releasing hormones into your body.
Correct. So people who have contraindication for hormones, who don't want any foreign hormones in their body, who have had side effects on the pill and that sort of thing, sometimes really benefit from that. Then the other type of coil, which is a relatively more modern, I mean, we're talking about 25 years now, yeah? releases a very small amount of progesterone, which also has an effect locally. So it does go to the circulation and you may feel some general side effects from it. It's because it releases progesterone in the uterus, it does affect your cycle. Initially, you can have irregular spotting for a while, and then your periods become very light and very, may not come at all, if you're very lucky.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you want.
Of course, from the medical point of view, doctors vary in their opinion. I love Mirena's, okay? I love them in this because they make the uterus go dormant. If the uterus is dormant, you're not going to have the effects of hormonal imbalances happening there, particularly as you grow older, and it keeps everything very much in check. But not everyone agrees with that. Most of all the doctors like that. I find them very effective.
Is there one that's more suited to people that have had children and others that are perhaps yet to have children?
People who have not had children have classically been told not to have a coil put in. Okay, because of its risk of associated infection. However, in all fairness, that is now changing. We've been putting Mirena's in for a long time. And the reason for that is because the progesterone thickens the cervical mucus and doesn't allow ascending infections as much into the uterus. So the risk of an STD in somebody who's, you know, young and is much less. So that has been going on for a long time. With regards to a copper coil in a young girl, if there are special indications and if we have advised her and told her exactly what the risks are, then we are putting copper coils in young unmarried people as well, because some people just can't deal with hormones.
Mm-hmm. Hope that helps, Naysha. I think we can squeeze in one more. Combination pill question here, saying I've been taking the combination pill for 2 years, but I've always had breaks every month. This month was the first time I decided to go back to back, except now I've been bleeding for 2 weeks and there's no sign of it stopping. Should I see my nurse?
No, don't worry. It's not a problem that you go back to back. You must be on probably a low dose pill, and that's the reason why it happened that you spotted for such a long time. It can, of course, still happen even with the normal dose pills. It's just an inconvenience, not a problem. We'll see what happens next over the next 2 months, at least, not even over the next month, over the next 2 months, and then just take it from there.
So an inconvenience, but not necessarily cause for concern at this stage.
Correct.
Claire is asking something. Now, Claire, I think you must be my spirit animal. Claire is asking, my youngest child is 3, and since pregnancy, I've experienced loss of memory and general vagueness. I'm not sure how else to put it. Conversations, tasks, dates, and more simply escape me, and it's frustrating me and my husband. If feels like more than just baby brain. Can I do anything?
Yes, she should really go for a checkup, okay? A general checkup, but most importantly, a hormone checkup, yeah? A blood test for her hormones. Sometimes, because after pregnancy and after breastfeeding, you don't have a period for a while, then it doesn't highlight that certain metabolic issues have taken place. Have developed, and the metabolic issues can lead to you having a vagueness. Yeah,
I know exactly what she means as well, because I sometimes am prone to just staring off in the middle of a conversation and my husband's practically clicking his fingers in front of my eyes. Are there any supplements that could help? Or
yes, there are, but you only go to supplements after you've done the hormone investigations.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of people who have this sort of situation have insulin resistance. So they have polycystic ovary syndrome that has led to insulin resistance. That gives them the hypos, and during that hypo phase, you are, you know, blanked out, mm-hmm. and unfortunately cannot concentrate, very irritated, hungry, and in some people, you know, they flare up, they become angry.
Irritable,
that's the word I was looking for.
Okay, so definitely worth to going to the doctor for a bit of a blood test and hormone screening to see if there's any imbalances.
Correct.
There. Hope that helps, Claire, and if you... Well, let's just say you're not alone. Do keep those questions coming in for Dr. Rosalie Sant. We're here until 1 o'clock talking all things gynecological. So if there's got any fertility concerns, hormones, pregnancy questions, we are here to help. It's Ion Health and we are talking about all things gynecological until 1 o'clock as I'm joined by Dr. Rosalie Sant from the Primavera Clinic in Healthcare City. Dr. Rosalie Sant, I saw something really sad, for want of a better word, in the press recently. About a 22-year-old woman called Katie Johnson, mm-hmm. who at just 22 is going through the menopause. Okay. She's had severe endometriosis, and her doctors offered the chance for her to be induced into the change. I always find the change such a kind of bizarre euphemism. She's going to remain menopausal for at least a year, and she's having injections every 3 months with the aim of giving her reproductive system a chance to calm down. She had years of painful periods, cramps, vomiting, headaches, and a huge frustration of the doctors not really understanding the pain she was in. What is endometriosis?
Endometriosis is a condition that's unfortunately not very well understood, and that's why doctors sometimes don't know how to communicate it to patients. It's when the lining of the uterus that responds to hormones and thickens and bleeds every month actually goes through the tubes, and the cells remain alive on the ovaries or somewhere inside your tummy. So there are endometrial cells inside the abdomen that grow and bleed every month with your cycle. Right. Now, of course, if you're going to have bleeding and that sort of congestion inside your abdomen, of course you're going to have a lot of pain. So these people, unfortunately, are in chronic pain that is exacerbated at the time of their period. And true that you can sort of operate and try and remove as much as possible of these cells, but some of them are microscopic. So within a couple of years of surgery, they will reappear. So that's the reason why this lady has been put on an induced menopause. It's not as bad as I thought it was in the beginning, because I thought it was a natural menopause. An induced menopause will reverse. It's just uncomfortable for her while she's on it. And of course, we try and relieve the symptoms of the menopause with the hormone replacement therapy. But not having any hormonal activity will hopefully shrink her endometriotic cells that are outside the uterus and then control her condition.
Here is Katie talking about her condition and her treatment.
I have been massively affected by my diagnosis. Going through menopause at 22 is the most bizarre thing in the world. I'm having a hot flash. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm Katie. I'm 22 and I have endometriosis. Endometriosis is a gynecological condition that affects 1 in 10 women in the UK. Cells that are usually found inside the uterus are found elsewhere in the body. Every time you ovulate, cells drain away in the same way that a period would, but the blood has nowhere to go. So it forms these horrible cysts and sticky clots and create a real painful, uncomfortable sort of mess inside you. I've always had painful periods from the age of about 16. They started to get extremely bad to the point where I would have to take 3 or 4 days out of school. From these monthly bouts for years, which I kind of just chalked off to what everyone else said, being a woman, go home and have a hot water bottle, take a stronger painkiller, but also I know my body and I know that this is not something that I could possibly be faking. I was vomiting maybe 6 or 7 times a day. I just kind of collapsed. I had stage 4 endometriosis, an enlarged fallopian tube which had expanded to the same size as my womb, and my bowel and my uterus were fused together. Going through menopause at 22 is the most bizarre thing in the world. It's a really jarring concept to say, I'm going to put your ovaries on pause. Aha, but will they come back on? Can you guarantee that? And yeah, they say they can. But I'm really grateful to be on the menopause. I know my body's getting a break. I'll take a hot flush over agonizing cramps any day of the week. It seems to me that once you have one symptom, you realize that every pain you've ever felt have relevance that you never understood before. Horrendous menstrual cramps, chronic pain and fatigue, vomiting, fainting, pain during sex, anxiety, depression, all symptomatic. The condition can be incredibly isolating. Goodbye to the things that make you feel human. I wasn't able to go out of the house. I wasn't able to meet friends for a coffee. I certainly wasn't able to do the extra kind of curricular stuff that I enjoy, like singing, standing up and doing an intense warm-up to sing a song. It was really too much for me for a long time. I don't know whether it's something we're programmed to do as women or whether it's something that society has ingrained in us that we just don't talk about it. Until we can acknowledge in our own minds that something's up and that we have a right to speak about it, we're not going to talk about it. You don't get a badge of honour for suffering. As if one GP says to you, no, you're being a hypochondriac, then just go somewhere else. If they are not prepared to listen to you, somebody will be. What it is just the idea that we need to end the silence surrounding endometriosis. An Instagram account isn't going to change the world, but what it will do is give people in Scotland who are going through these symptoms content that actually makes sense to them. As women, we've got to come together at the most basic thing, which is that we have the same sort of experience. So we should all be able to talk about it.
There you go. That was 22-year-old Katie Johnson talking about her induced menopause to help her deal with the symptoms of endometriosis, which does affect 1 in 10 women of productive age in the UK, and actually is a factor in as many as 30 to 50% of women with infertility issues. Lots of questions for you, Dr. Rosalie Sant. Are you ready?
I am.
Mumita's been in touch saying, I have a unilateral cleft lip and palate. I'm 30. I'm planning to get pregnant, but scared of passing on this deformity to my child. What are the chances of this nightmare becoming true? Is there anything I can do before pregnancy to avoid transferring the genes to my baby? Please help. I'm super nervous. I'm from India.
Usually, cleft palates are actually not hereditary, and they're usually not, and they're definitely not genetic. If they're part of a syndrome, they may be. But if they're an isolated finding, they're usually not linked to chromosomal problems. They are linked to exposure to certain chemicals before or during the pregnancy. So what I would advise her to do is actually make sure that she goes as clean as possible away from chemicals, both in what she eats, what she uses, what she exposes herself to. Make sure she has no mineral and vitamin deficiencies before she gets pregnant, and then just maintain a healthy life throughout the pregnancy. And it's extremely unlikely that she's going to be fortunate enough to have that issue again with her child.
Okay, I hope that helps me to put your mind at ease. Christina's been in touch saying, I'm 42 and have the Mirena coil. When should I start looking into hormones for the menopause, or are there any natural vitamins recommended to women at this age?
So somebody with a Mirena at 42 is, especially if somebody who does not have a period, may worry that they're in the menopause. And unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, there's no way of finding out except through a blood test. So if she starts feeling different to usual, so she's not concentrating, she just doesn't feel herself, then she definitely should go to for a checkup to check if she needs any hormones. But really, at 42, it's unlikely that she needs hormones. All she'd need would supplementation, natural vitamins, make sure vitamin D is fine, especially in this country, because we need our bone strength, which is the one thing that we worry about when we approach the menopause, and make sure that there aren't any other deficiencies, and just keep healthy and exercise.
And when it comes to the Mirena coil, how long does it stay in for? How long do you recommend using it for?
Both coils stay in for 5 years, and I've had people who have had the fourth one changed, so they can be in for 20 years or more. It doesn't matter.
Great. Okay, great to know. Thank you for that question, Christina. Message here from P saying, I've had what I can only describe as fluttering on my right-hand side, low, near where I would guess my ovary is. I'm not pregnant, but it feels like kicking. That sounds disconcerting.
It's not uncommon to have odd sensations down in a tummy. And of course, because we always link the lower part of our abdomen with our gynecological side, we always think it's either the ovaries or something like that.
Or appendix.
That's right. That's right. So the most common is actually bowel that that causes some sort of the sensation in that area that we mistake for ovary. You always have to time the sensation. So if it's obviously at the time of ovulation or just before bowel movement or whatever. But the other thing that fools us, and it's always by elimination that we reach diagnosis, is muscle pain. Okay, in that area, there is the iliopsoas muscle that connects your leg to your back. And if it is a repeated movement, if it's like a flutter, she described. So if it's like a repeated movement, it's like almost like a hiccup. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then the chances are that's muscle.
Okay. So rather than the gynae, perhaps a GP appointment to eliminate the bowel and muscular spasms.
That's right.
Okay, hope that helps. Message here, no name on this one, saying my PCOS, so polycystic ovary syndrome, medication, does it have side effects such as mood swings? I'm so up and down and considering coming off. Are there any alternatives?
So PCO in its own right causes a lot of mood swings.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So she may be getting mood swings from the treatment or from the fact that her PCO is not very well controlled. Okay.
Right.
Because so that is very important to distinguish, because medication does not cure polycystic ovary syndrome. A change of lifestyle does. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of people want the quick route out and they actually ask for medication. But if it's not accompanied by change of lifestyle, then they're still going to have the symptoms of it. Depending on what medication she's on, yes, there are alternatives. In the past, we always used to give glucophage and only glucophage, but now there are things like inositol and acetylcysteine, and there are some minerals that help with the insulin metabolism, that help with polycystic ovary syndrome. However, really, we go back to lifestyle, diet and exercise and that sort of thing.
Okay. Hope that helps there. Rich is asking, my wife's first delivery was cesarean. Is there any chance of second delivery being, quote, normal? And if so, any risks?
For sure. Okay. The international statistic is that 70% of people who had a first cesarean can have a normal delivery for the second one. But that needs qualification, because you really need to go back and look why she had a cesarean. I mean, if she had a breech and she had a cesarean for that, then of course there was no indication that her pelvis is not of good size or whatever. But however, if she was 10 centimetres dilated and the baby wouldn't rotate and the pelvis was seen to be small, the pelvis hasn't changed. Yeah. So unless this time she's got a very, very small baby, then of course the pelvis is still going to be the same size and her chances of a successful VBAC, we call them VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, then the chances are going to be very low. So you first of all need to see why she needed a section the first time around. Then you need to see how the body and this baby are interacting together towards the end of the pregnancy. And then if all is positive, why not try?
And if that's what she wants, then
that's right.
If you've got a doctor that can support you in that, then power to you. Wishing you and your wife all the very best, Rich. More of your questions after this. I'm Helen Farmer. Lots of text messages coming in for our gynecologist. We've got Dr. Rosalie Sant here. Question here for you, doctor, saying, I work in a lab and I'm exposed to formaldehyde.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I should avoid exposure during pregnancy, but is that the case for breastfeeding too?
Probably, yes. Probably, I would say. In all fairness, formaldehyde is actually dangerous for everyone, even if you're not pregnant. So it's probably a carcinogen. So we should really try and avoid exposure to it and use a fume cupboard whenever you're dealing with it.
Okay. And Jana's saying, I'm 39. I've had three healthy pregnancies and children. Recently had a miscarriage at 8 weeks. Sorry to hear that, Jana. Heartbeat was present at 6 weeks and then stopped at 8 weeks. Blood test shows slightly high thyroid levels. I'm now taking thyroxin 25 mg. Doctor thinks this could have caused the miscarriage. Is this true?
Oh, it's very difficult to say what happens when you miscarry at 8 weeks. We try and understand what is happening, but it's very difficult to pinpoint it and to say that it's because of the thyroid. I think that's probably quite, you know, I wouldn't be so convinced. I would say a chromosomal abnormality, just a mistake of that particular pregnancy, not because she's got predisposition for anything. It's just it's such a complicated process, and is more likely. And it's you had three babies, you know, it's extremely unlikely it's going to happen again, and shouldn't stop her from trying again if she'd like to.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? You know, before I was a mum, I just didn't think about everything that's involved. I didn't think about how hard it is to get pregnant and stay pregnant and have a healthy baby. It's really is so many complicated and sometimes completely mysterious factors.
Very much
sometimes
so.
A bit of luck and bad luck as well. So Jana, really sorry to hear that and wishing you all the best.
I used to run a recurrent miscarriage. I still am very interested in a recurrent miscarriage clinic. So I'm very, I see this very often. Mm-hmm. So when I see the heart, I said, thank goodness for that every single time, because you can never take anything for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a complicated process.
I used to get what I called scanxiety before every scan that I had. And my husband never understood it. I used to go really quiet, was really scared, was really emotional because...
Aww.
You just didn't know. And then I kind of walk out of the clinic kind of just quiet and reflective. It's a very surreal experience. It really is. Sarika is asking here on the text line saying, I'm 39 years old, been diagnosed with fibroids 2.6 centimetres in size, and I also take contraceptive pills. Can you please advise how to treat the fibroids and its effect on my periods?
So if it's 2.6 centimetres, it's a small fibroid. So the next question to ask is, where is it within the uterus? The only time when a 2.6 centimetre fibroid is relevant is if it's impinging on the cavity, if it's inside the cavity of the uterus or putting pressure on the lining of the uterus, because then it will give you heavy periods. But if it's in any other place in the uterus, you just leave it well alone, you just watch it, she can continue with her pill, just do a scan every year and just see the rate of growth. And most fibroids grow very slowly and never give us any problems, really.
Okay, hope that helps, Sarika. Question here, no name on this one, saying, hi, I'm in the early stages of pregnancy and I'm suffering from an irritating case of thrush. Any recommendations on what to use? I tried to ask the pharmacist, but they were reluctant to advise.
Yes, and that is right. She unfortunately needs to go to see a doctor. In pregnancy, we're very careful what to give. So we have to be 100% sure that of what infection it is. So she needs to go for a swab, really, and identify the infection and then take the treatment according to the swab result.
Okay. Back on the Marenacoil topic, I'm seriously considering having my Marenacoil taken out for good. The 5 years is up this September. My mood swings are up and down. Breasts can be very painful for at least a week per month. Low sex drive. And most importantly, I've gained so much weight. I'm not sure if that's the coil or not, though. I hope so. Will removal help?
Well, it is a reasonable thing to suspect that it may be coil related, because it is a small amount of hormone that may affect the body. So it would be wise for her to remove the coil at this stage. Whether it's going to solve her problem or not, we just have to wait and see. You see, over 5 years, especially 5 years of not having regular periods, the metabolism may have changed and she may have not noticed. Mm-hmm. And she may have been putting on the weight and getting the mood swings and this and that because of the metabolic changes.
Yeah, that's the thing. We do gain weight as we get older. And she doesn't say how old she is here, but it could part of aging.
But it's a wise thing to do to remove the coil because, it's, as I said, one of the side effects of progesterone in some people is a tendency for depression and an effect on libido. And we cannot predict who is going to be sensitive to it. Mm-hmm. So if you have noticed a significant change, then it's wise to remove it and see what happens to you.
Okay. No name on this one saying, I'm just wondering if I could be pregnant. My last period ended on 20th May, so it's about 7 weeks late. And I've done about 7 pregnancy tests, all of which say negative. I've had a few days where I felt sick and threw up a few times, but I don't know if it's in my head worrying about it. Apart from that, no other symptoms. This past week, I've been having mild period pains. And yes, I went to the toilet and saw a little bit of blood, but that was the last of it. Could I still be pregnant, even though the tests are saying negative?
If they're good quality tests and they've been stored properly, it's extremely unlikely they're wrong. Okay, and all 7 of them. So if she's still in doubt, she can go and have a blood test done for a pregnancy, and that is definitely always right or wrong. The unfortunate thing is that if you have a cyst in your ovary, so it would be the cyst of the month that should disappear and allow a period to come, but it doesn't disappear, it continues to be active. And if you have that, it delays your period and gives you all the symptoms of pregnancy. Mm. And that's what she may be having, of the nausea and everything else.
And I guess stress doesn't help your period to come on either.
No, not at all.
Speaking from experience. Dr. Rosalie Sant, thank you so much for coming in. An hour absolutely whizzed by.
It did.
So people can find you at the Primavera Clinic in Healthcare City.
Dubai Healthcare City.
And you deliver babies. What's been the biggest baby you've delivered recently?
4.6 kilos.
Oh, crossing my legs. Well, congratulations to that mummy. And wishing you all the very best
for the
summer as well.
Thanks, Brenda.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.